The Alan Watts iPhone app is now available on the iTunes App Store, featuring the entire Alan Watts podcast series at your fingertips. Visit alanwattsapp.com for more information.
Now, I want to go today into the subject of the male-female symbolism in tantric yoga. You will find that in the tantric art forms, that every Buddha or aspect of the Buddha has a feminine counterpart. And that not only do they have feminine counterparts, but they also have various levels on which they're represented. In other words, we started out, you remember, I described in the last seminar, there were the idea of five so-called Jnani Buddhas. And these five, who represent, as it were, the center of a rose, one's in the middle and four surround. Then each one has a corresponding bodhisattva form. And then each bodhisattva has in turn a corresponding heruka form, but they're all forms of the original five. Then whether they're in the form of a Jnani Buddha, or in the form of a bodhisattva, or in the form of a heruka, which is kind of wrathful and weird, far out to kind of a character often with bull's heads. This one here, which we can look at, is a little statue that Kim has brought over. They're all reducible to the original group. And all have these female counterparts, and they are represented as in sexual intercourse, touching at all points, in a complete embrace. And the idea is that this embrace lasts forever and ever and ever and ever and never ends. Because this is a way of representing the nature of life. What is fundamentally involved in this system is self-knowledge. You see, if without resonance nothing happens, if there are no echoes, you can't hear anything. Supposing we get a room in which we blanket all the walls and blanket the floor, soundproof it in every possible direction, you can hardly hear anyone talk. Because voice requires resonance. That's why people enjoy singing in the bathtub. They suddenly discover they've got a good voice. Because suddenly the bath and the structure of the room, which is all non-soundproofed, resonates their voice. That's why you use a violin or a cello or a bass fiddle has a wooden structure to make the sound resonant, to play back to itself. And that's why we are all so fascinated with recording things, taking photographs, writing them down, and above all, remembering. It's a form of resonance. Because you see, if you don't remember anything, you don't know you're there. A person who had total amnesia and lived in a split second only wouldn't know he was there. We could conceive, and perhaps there are some forms of life that don't know they're there. I don't know whether my particular cells constituting my body, I don't know whether they know they're there. Maybe they do. Maybe they have some wonderful system of resonance that I know nothing about, and they're all worried about what I'm going to do with them. And having conferences and meetings and policy decisions and so on and so forth, because this person in charge, you know, it might well be that when I die, or when we all die, all our cells suddenly say, God is dead. And they have their big theological controversy. And say, well, We just have to fend for ourselves from now on. And that's called corruption, when they all go off on their own. I don't know. It may be that we've got some kind of a system like that. But certainly, to know that you're there, you need an echo. So I invented this limerick. There was a young man who said, though, it seems that I know that I know. What I would like to see is the eye that knows me when I know that I know that I know. So this is the thing, you see. Not only do you remember what happened and say it made an impression on me, which means it made me remember, like your retina remembers whatever is seen, so that it sticks there a little. In other words, that's why you get the illusion of a circle of fire when you revolve a cigarette in the dark. It makes the impression of a circle because your retina remembers and holds, as it were, the impression of the flame. And so then, beyond that, we are absolutely fascinated with the whole principle of remembering. And so then, when there's some gathering of people, and we say, well, this is a great day, what a wonderful picnic or whatever it is we're having, it's a pity somebody didn't bring a camera. It should have been photographed. Now, do you see that in this whole thing, there is both a gain and a loss? One school of people are saying it should be photographed. The other school of people are saying, let go of it. When you go around, we had so much experience of this in Japan, because all our students brought cameras and were constantly photographing things. And I had a camera and I was constantly photographing things, but I felt that so long as I had a camera with me, I was somehow distracted from actuality. I had a little box with which I went around grabbing life. Of course, it's great to come back and look at it in the form of photographs, but there's something about the photograph that is inferior to the actual experience that you're photographing. But there is an immense fascination in photography, in painting, in reproducing. And reproducing, you see, is the same thing as sexuality. It is reproduction, only in another way. Because it tells you you're there, you're alive. The thing bounces, it echoes. So the duplicity in all this is, you see, one school of religious people say, let it all go, don't be attached. In other words, and they also say, live in the moment. Like Krishnamurti's doctrine of stop trying to remember everything. You may need a kind of factual memory for your name and address and telephone number and things like that. But don't linger over memories and treasure memories and say, well, I'm going to keep my girlfriend's lock of hair and I'll take it out every now and then and look at it and feel wonderful, you see. That's clinging to life, because that memory has got you hooked. It holds you to the past, and it holds you to death. But then there's the other school of thought, you see, quite opposite to this, which says, remember to remember, title of one of Henry Miller's books. Hold on to it all. Get involved. Keep your girlfriend's hair. Keep all the photographs. You know how in some houses the piano, everything is completely covered with photographs and reminiscences. I went to visit Gloria Swanson once. I've never seen such a house full of memories. Everything in all directions was Gloria Swanson. Photographed on this occasion, signed on that occasion, presentation this. I went to visit once too the wife of a former Archbishop of Canterbury. And the whole house was memorials. I mean, it was a complete clutter of tombstone furniture with little brass plates on it, presented on the occasion of this, that, and the other. Well, you say, look, that person isn't really living. And they're all in the past.
But on the other hand, what is life, you see, except there is a memory, except there is an echo? So what I want to point out, you see, is the duplicity of all this. That you don't take, if you're a wise man, you don't take sides in this issue. You do both sides. And that is the meaning of the unity of samsara and nirvana. On the one hand, you let go of everything and you live in the eternal now. Because that's all there is. See, memory is an illusion. It's all gone. So everything you know about that makes an impression on you is no longer there. That's the meaning of Maya. There is only the eternal now. There is only the present moment. There never will be anything else. Because even what you're remembering is happening in the present. The memory is in the eternal now, isn't it? See? So it's all really absolutely here. But on the other hand, what fun to drag it out and to make it echo and to get involved and to fall in love and to become attached. Once R.H. Blythe wrote and said to me, I may have told some of you this story before, he wrote me a letter and said, what are you doing these days? As for me, I am abandoning all kinds of satori and enlightenment, and I'm trying to become as deeply attached to as many people and as many things as possible. As these are the two sides, see? So, the thing is this. It's just like riding a bicycle. It's a balance trick. You suddenly find yourself falling over one way, well, you balance that, you turn into that direction, and you stay up. And so in the same way, when you find yourself becoming too attached to life, you correct that with the realization that there is nothing except the eternal now. Then when you feel that's all right now, you see, you're safe again, this is only the eternal now, once more you go and get attached. Or you get involved, you get concerned about some enterprise, social, political, amorous, familial, scholarly, artistic, whatever it is, you get involved. And the two always go together. So this is the meaning of this symbolism. Because the male only knows he's there if there's a female. It's the echo. And she only knows she's there if there's a male. Nobody ever came into existence without a couple of parents, see? And there's simply no other way into this universe. Now, this is simply, I'm using this simply not as the main point, but as a sort of illustration of the simultaneity of attachment, detachment, involution and evolution. Involution is how you get involved, evolution is how you get out. Well now, this tantric yoga represents all this in the most extraordinary symbolism, which is basically the human body. Again, it's not simply the sexual functioning of the human body, it's the whole nervous system. If you really dig into this, you will find that there is a psychic anatomy, and this psychic anatomy in yoga philosophy belongs to what I explained yesterday as the subtle body. You must not expect to find this in the physical organism, nor must you expect to find that there is, in addition to the physical organism, a sort of spook that goes round with us. The physical body is the body as examined by others. The subtle body is the way you feel yourself. Now, there is an anatomy of the subtle body, which consists of the process of involution and evolution. There is a spinal tree, And it's represented as having two paths down it. It is represented as a canal called the Sushumna. And then in this canal there are two routes. One is called the Ida and the other is called the Pingala. P-I-N-G-L-A and the I-D-A, Ida. And on one current, something is going down. And on the other, something is coming up. And you will recognize, I think, the familiar image of two serpents on a rod, the caduceus, carried by Mercury. And alchemically, you see, Mercury, the mirror substance, is the void, is the pure, clear light, the same thing as the Buddhist diamond.
Listening to Alan Watts from the Spoken Word Library of the Electronic University. For copies of this and other Alan Watts programs, please go to alanwatts.com on the World Wide Web or call us toll-free at 1-800-WO-WATTS. That's ALANWATTS.com or 1-800-WO-WATTS. The Watts website features free audio downloads, program lists, and information on Watts' life and works. Once again, that's alanwatts.com or 1-800-WO-WATTS.